Hi, I'm Stephanie Shelton, and this is Conversations on Health, How We Get There. Dr. Lisa Lane is a Renaissance woman. It's hard to characterize her exactly because she's worn so many hats and she's worn them all so well. After getting a master's degree in international relations, she became a foreign service officer. Then she came home to New Jersey, got a doctorate in medical humanities and additional certificates in bioethics and medical humanities. And then she became a patient advocate at a New Jersey hospital. These days, she's an adjunct professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University. And she has unique perspectives on those who dispense healthcare and those who get healthcare, both here and abroad. I asked Lisa how she's managed to jump from one career to another, and still land on her feet.
No, actually, they all connect. One leads right into the other. The first foreign service part was from the beginning of my childhood, and that my parents always wanted me to do something international. And it never occurred to me to be a diplomat. And I thought of working at the UN, possibly as an interpreter. And when I went to graduate school, those are the days you didn't think about, what am I going to do when I get out? I just knew I would be doing something. And I was called into the dean's office wondering, what did I do? And he looked at me and he asked me, what do you plan to do? And I said, I don't know. And he said, you are going into the Foreign Service.
Whoa.
And I went, okay. That was it. That's what he wanted to see me about. I didn't even know he knew who I was or anything. He said to you. And then actually 2 months later, I was in the Foreign Service.
And then when you decided that enough was enough, you went on to get a doctorate in medical humanities. How did that happen?
Well, when I came back from the Foreign Service, I was looking for a job. And again, I ran into someone, actually I had been in a little bit in broadcasting, and then someone in broadcasting knew someone who was looking for a patient representative, and I got the job as a patient representative. And then driving to work one day, I heard an advertisement for the medical humanities program at Drew, and I thought, that's it. My love of literature combined with health. And this thing I have about justice and, and what's fair and bioethics. So actually, I've heard about a program at Columbia for the bioethics certificate. So I did that. Then I heard about Drew, and it all sort of fit together.
Serendipitously.
Yeah, just one, all fits
one
together.
One could say.
Right.
So, as you know, this is a podcast that's mostly about healthcare and healthcare systems, mm-hmm. and how they work or don't work, and how people can use them or can't use them or won't use them. Why does a person need specialized training? Or let's put it this way, why should it be necessary for a person to get specialized training to kind of put themselves between a person or a patient and a healthcare provider or a hospital or a system?
That's a good question.
Is it unique to us, the United States?
No, it's not. I think a lot has to do with many people are afraid of the healthcare. They're afraid of getting sick. So that when they see a healthcare provider, they just sort of clam up. They don't say anything. I know when I go to a doctor, I was at the doctor the other day for a checkup, and she walked in and she said, hi, Lisa, how are you? And I went, is everything well? And I went, yes. Just, zipped. But I do it. And sometimes you need someone who is detached, but they can still feel how you're feeling, or they can see how you're feeling and get you to come out of your shell and get you to talk to your provider. Maybe the idea of the medical humanities, it used to be the art of medicine, to which I think people understood that. Then it became really the science of medicine. And that's where I think you lost the general public. The scientists became very specialized. The doctors became the elitists, you know, the ones in power. And I think people are generally afraid. And people don't want to know what's really wrong with them.
No, goodness knows you don't want to be the recipient of news you've got cancer or something. And I often wonder, you know, when I go to a doctor's appointment, and I've known I still call him a GP, a general practitioner, mm-hmm. But when I go to my primary care doctor, whom I've known for years, and we sit around and we talk for the 15 minutes he's allowed to talk to me, but sometimes I think, because we're laughing away, and I think, what if this doctor had just come from telling somebody that they have terminal anything, you know, heart disease, cancer, whatever, and they're going to die. And here I am talking to him like nothing is wrong. And you can't possibly know that as a patient.
Yes, but there's nothing wrong with dying. And that's what your doctor has already learned. For a good doctor, dying is part of the life cycle. And maybe the circumstances might be tragic. But if you know it's going to happen, sometimes that's a blessing if you know when it's going to happen. Most of us don't. But I think a doctor can compartmentalize it so much better because he or she sees it as a life cycle. I think that's why they can do it. Also, for the patient, he's just finished telling you, no, you're dying. Then he sees the next patient who is joyous, sort of lifts him up.
Well, that's
it's a cycle. You just don't stop. We stop at the horrible news. But I think all people who receive horrible news, there comes a time, either it's walking out the door, or you happen to be sitting somewhere, or you hear a bird sing, or something that will make you smile despite yourself, that will take you out of your misery for a few minutes, or even a few seconds. And that's what doctors have to learn how to do, especially doctors who treat cancer patients.
Hmm.
Even for children, pediatric cancer, think how disheartening that must be.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay, so given what you've just said, why do you tell me, which when we were talking before you did, that you think doctors have to learn not to be so arrogant?
Because quite a few of them are. Notice I didn't say all of them. I would just say, you know, you learn so much in medical school, and you die. I'm in awe of the amount of knowledge they carry with them, that they can absorb it and learn so much. And sometimes that can kind of go to your head, like, I'm really smart. And there has to be a voice or something into you say, you are smart by the grace of the powers that be, by the grace of God. You have a talent. Don't let it go to your head.
Yeah.
Acknowledge it, but don't let it go to your head. And maybe it has to do with young doctors are going into. You know how many doctors go into medicine, they never wanted to be a doctor to begin with?
No, I would actually hope everybody would want to be a doctor.
Nope.
Who goes into it?
No, for example, many South Asian families and African families, you have a choice. You can be a doctor, preferably an engineer or something else, but it has to be a doctor. And so many people become doctors because they're smart and they feel that it'll satisfy what their families want, or they think in terms of the money, but they don't go in it for people.
That's the same thing about becoming a lawyer or, you know, an accountant or a lot of the professions that the families kind of push mm-hmm. you into, when really what you want to be is a car mechanic, you know? I mean, seriously, there are lots of people that we push into professions because your family, especially an immigrant family, for example, wants you to do better than they did as a child. And sometime in the middle of life, you realize that, no, I really want to do something else, and the lucky people change to it.
I think my family actually was not that different, in that for them, it was like, you know, you'll do something international. Hey, look, that got me into the Foreign Service.
So we were talking about doctors who don't always end up going into a profession that they want to be in. You said when we were discussing this something further, you said that doctors have to learn to trust their patients. What did you mean by that?
No one knows their own body better than the person themselves. So a doctor has to be trained, or should be trained, to listen to what the patient is saying. The patient may not know how to articulate it in medical terms, but what they're saying, if he can make the patient relax enough in that 15 minutes, relax enough to say how they truly feel, he must be able to interpret that. But a patient can say, you can say, you know, I just feel this knot in my stomach all the time, and not brush it off as nerves. Mm. So that's, they have to trust their patients for the patients to know their body.
So basically, if the patient feels that something isn't normal for them, the doctor needs to listen because it isn't normal.
Right. It isn't for them, and it may turn out to be something that's harmless, but it is something that is part of the physical person. And when we do have senses for a reason, it's one of the reasons we feel pain to tell us that, you know, something isn't quite right, or you have a high fever that tells you that, you know, you're fighting germs. So doctors need to listen. I knew a doctor when I was taking my mother to the doctor when she was older. And the doctor kept on looking at their computer. When I got home, my mother asked me, "Why do you think he's looking at the computer? Is that telling him what to do or say?" And I went, "No, Mommy, he's doing the medical record. It's going in." But she really asked that question. You know, she asked the question like, "So, if you spend all your time talking to the patient, and you're at your computer and you never look at the patient, I mean, how do you expect to get anything?"
You know, I am completely tuned in to the technical world. And I've been going to this doctor, as I said, for a long time, and I'm doing the same thing for a long time. I came out of my annual physical this time around, and I even said to my husband, you know, he just sits there and you're talking to him and he's typing it into the computer, and you have this sense that you're not having a conversation at all. But they have to. So that's the problem. They have to, because they got to go from you to the next one. They can't sit there for 5 minutes and type out their memories and their notes. And is that our system?
Well, it looks as if what it's going to be. Looks as what it's going to be. As someone said, doctors really became detached from the patients when the stethoscope was invented. Before that, they had to kind of listen.
Well, that's true. They would put their...
The ears, they would listen.
Ear, yeah.
But that's when technology really began to step in. But now, what I still can't wrap my head around, and I got a notice in the mail the other day that my insurance carrier had this new system, that you could have a video wellness checkup.
Yes.
And I'm going, I'm still, maybe I'm old fashioned, but so, you know, it's a video.
I think a lot of the telemedicine is meant to replace going to the emergency room. Certainly for a lot of people who, and it runs across income levels and education levels. People tend not to go to the doctor, mm-hmm. even though perhaps, let's say if you're on Medicare will pay for not an annual physical, but an annual wellness visit, which is, you know, for a journalist, that's like, come on, it's a physical. Why call it wellness? But for example, it won't pay for the blood tests,
right?
As a wellness visit. So, or a physical visit. So the doctor has to kind of invent some reason to do a blood test on you. Well, you complained about something that we really better test the blood. and then Medicare pays for it. I mean, these are the shortcomings in our system. My friends in the Czech Republic, if they go for an annual, they go for an annual. Mm-hmm. And their taxes that they have paid out of their salaries and that their employers have paid and that the government has paid for people who don't have jobs or don't have salaries or can't afford out of their minuscule salaries, it's seamless. It's so seamless over there. And over here, we seem to have to parse every
it's
move.
It's an effort. It really is an effort, you know, to go. You see one physician, then you have to go for the blood test, and then say, well, I'm going to send you for something else. And it's all junty. Nothing runs smoothly. Unless, of course, you're in a hospital bed. You're in one place, but nobody wants to be there.
No. And because you've lived in other countries and you've gotten sick in other countries, mm-hmm. what is it like compared to here?
Kinder.
Uh-huh.
I would say that's my big... I thought about that in coming here today. What was the biggest difference? Kindness. Maybe it's because I was a foreigner in a foreign land. I don't know. But a sense of kindness, of caring. And if you get sick in a culture that it isn't rush, 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 it's even better because the doctors aren't sitting here going, I only got 15 minutes, I have to go. So I would say kindness, caring, but also honesty. Sometimes brutal honesty. You know, they when you're in a foreign hospital, doctors and nurses tend to cut to the chase. They're honest with you.
Why?
Maybe because they don't know you as a foreigner. Maybe because it's the most efficient. It's the most efficient. Maybe as in America, we've learned to talk our way around everything.
Maybe they have a more, going back to what you were saying about doctors seeing death as just part of a continuum, maybe they have a more realistic or down-to-earth or ancient, maybe, if you want to view of illness and the cycle of life.
That depends on the culture and where exactly, you know, you are. But more and more that's disappearing as, like, Western medicine takes over.
Okay, you're a bioethicist, right?
It's been a long time.
How do you meld this concept of kinder medicine, kinder healthcare, or something that people can trust more easily for the people who don't trust healthcare, with modern science and all the wonderful progress that we have made medically in all countries now?
That's a hard one. And that's, I don't know. It's like how to bring the kindness back into medicine, how to bring the honesty back into medicine. Maybe it has to be left to that person in the middle, that bioethicist or that patient advocate. In terms of like elder care, perhaps we have to look back to the family unit. I really don't know the answer to that one. I hadn't really thought about it. How to bring the caring back? I could say it's a trend. It'll go back and forth, but I'm seeing every medicine and an artist getting more and more distant.
I mean, if you think back to COVID and the horribleness of people dying in hospital beds hooked up to equipment and not even allowed to see someone from their own family in the beginning because we didn't have enough coverings even for the doctors and nurses, sanitary coverings. And then it just got to be a hospital policy. Let's not bring anyone from the outside in with everything else or not let anything from the inside out. If they had been thinking more in your kind of way, they would have found a way so that you could say goodbye in person. It always struck me that that was just awful.
They didn't have time. COVID was a learning experience, and they had to use their learning. Perhaps now we can say that, but this was where the truth and its honesty had to be the first consideration. Kindness takes a little bit of time, and we didn't have time with COVID.
Really, also, I mean, was really,
also,
was it's
the fear, also fear.
Okay, fear.
Also, fear had a lot to do with it.
Fear of the unknown, I guess, because we knew so little.
That's it. That's fear of the unknown, I would say.
Do you think, and see, to me, when you talk about ethics, I talk about ethics a lot as a journalist. We as journalists talk about them in a different way. But it basically means, being true to yourself and being true to other people around you in that sense, and doing the best thing, the most decent thing, the right thing. That word right and ethics in my head go together. And do you think that from COVID, aside from learning how to deal with a pandemic, which we, of course, had never had for 100 years, we ever learned any of that, the medical profession?
I think the nursing profession did. I think the medical profession was kind of baffled by the whole thing. Again, everything was so fast, everything was so busy, everything was so strenuous, that the medical profession was called on. They're like, produce a cure. Mm-hmm. And it's almost as if they didn't have time for the caring. You might say that's where the medical profession, the nursing profession, I think kind of sort of split ways. So much of it was left to the nurses, the
Which
caring
is
part.
Probably why they're so burned out.
Oh, yes. Yes, because to not be burned out, you need the self-nurturing. That's why when I was a patient advocate, I would emphasize to nurses, I'm here for you too. I'm here so that you don't get burned out or so frustrated that you can't get through to the patient. Let me try. Then you can go back in. I'm going to take some of the weight off your shoulder. You can do all, the medical thing, the nursing things. But in talking to the patient, that the frustration that comes, I can help eliminate some of that frustration because I've been trained to communicate.
I think you said the secret word there.
Communicate. Narrative. Mm-hmm. I know what can put people at ease. And that was a very hard lesson for many doctors to learn from a patient advocate, that we weren't trying to interfere in what you're doing. We're trying to make your job a little easier and getting through what you need to get through to the patient.
Yeah, I know. So often we say when we're looking for a doctor, some people want what I call a bedside manner, mm-hmm. From the old days. And some people just want someone who'll tell it to them straight, and who's a great doctor.
And one doesn't exclude the other.
Doesn't.
No, it doesn't. Definitely not. I've known some doctors that have been pretty direct, but no one would ever say they had a bad bedside manner. And, they knew how to address each patient. They knew who could take the news straight on, or who they had to sort of tell a roundabout story to. But you can still be direct and honest and still be kind.
Let me wind up this interview with a last question, which is not quite in your area, but you have been around observing the healthcare industry and the way we react with it a long time. And it seems to me one of the great problems is that the unserved or underserved when it comes to not medical care now, just, but health care. That's not being minimized like it should be. It may be even increasing. We saw that with vaccines, you know, where something will take on a political issue when it has nothing to do with politics. Do you see any possibility of us beginning to stress just better, healthy living that would, if you could live in a healthier manner, eat better, exercise better, kind of pay more attention to your own body and self, mentally as well as physically, you wouldn't need so much health care. There wouldn't be this problem of people not getting it because you might not need to go to the doctor so often or the emergency room every time you had a stomach ache.
But you see, what you're saying, all of that, living better, eating better, exercising more, that is still in the realm of the elite, of those people that have money. When you're poor and when you're hungry, you don't have time for that. Mm. When you are anywhere in the world, when you're trying to scrape making a living, all of what you've just mentioned is a luxury. It's a luxury. We as Americans, we pretty much see it as, you know, it's what we need for a healthy lifestyle. But many people can't afford a healthy lifestyle. I mean, if you don't have quality food in a poor area, and the vegetables and the fruits and all, well, one, you're not used to eating them, so you're not going to. And two, you can't afford them. And three, you can't get to them. Exercise. We talk about exercise, we talk about crime. People are now afraid to exercise or to be outside in the fresh air. That's going to affect health care. Living a better lifestyle, I would say we would have to, before we could do that, raise the economic profile of people. That's what I would really say.
All right, it's a good place to conclude a very wide-ranging interview, and thank you so much. Dr. Lisa Lane, former U.S. diplomat, patient advocate, and longtime teacher. She remains an adjunct professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and she teaches courses in cross-cultural perspectives and global issues. Well, in the next episode, I'm going to be talking to a psychologist. He's in the Czech Republic, and the Czechs are having issues with their mental health, just as we are, growing issues. But unlike here in the U.S., healthcare overall is paid for by the government from taxes. Now, does that in any way make a difference in the way Czechs look at mental health and whether they go and they get help when they need it? I'm scheduling one new podcast a month, so look for that one in April. Drop day usually is the third Tuesday of the month, and updates are wherever you get your podcasts. Please do subscribe. We're on Apple, Google, Spotify, TuneIn, iHeart, Podchaser, and my host platform, the Podbeam app. The video version is on YouTube. Show notes and links on my website, www.stephanieshelton.com/conversations. I'm Stephanie Shelton, and until I see you again, please take care of yourself and all of those that you love. Conversations on Health, How We Get There is produced and edited by Frank Harold. Research assistance from Dr. Richard Saltman, Professor Emeritus of Health Policy and Management, Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University in Atlanta.